Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. Got Kevin Barrett on today. Kevin is a scholar. He's a university lecturer. He's an author. He's done lots of things. And his book, at least one of them, is called Questioning the War on Terror. We need to do a lot of questioning on the War of Terror. I think regular listeners to this program know, unlike most people in the country, unfortunately, because they don't hear programs like this, they turn to you-know-what, and they shouldn't. The War on Terror is simply a device to let America wage real wars, committing terror anyway. Kevin rips apart conventional views in his book, and he exposes the motives behind it. They're all sinister. You know, you engender fear so you can wage imperial wars and claim the liberating ones, and so on and so forth. It's a dirty business. It's a real dirty business. Kevin, I welcome you. There's so much going on always. My God. I'm not certain what's most in your focus, but one thing that's caught my eye in recent days has been the saber rattling on Iraq. Iran. I'm sure you've paid attention to that as well.
Absolutely right, Steve. Good to be with you. And yeah, I think we're at another of these kind of crisis points where the nefarious forces of evil are pushing as hard as they can for that war with Iran. You know, it's happened a few other times. In the summer of 2007, as I recall, there was that moment where somebody was actually stealing nuclear weapons from the American arsenal at Minot Air Force Base and shipping them down to Barksdale in Louisiana, which was a staging point to the Middle East. So luckily they got nabbed, and a whole bunch of folks got suicided after that, apparently, which may not be a bad thing if they're planning to set off nuclear weapons. But in any case, we've been on the cusp of this kind of insane war with Iran several times, and it looks like we're right back to that cusp once again.
It's amazing. Next week, apparently, an IAEA report will come out that will suggest Iran is developing, that they have an active nuclear weapons program. I've written a few articles recently, Kevin, and I wrote one this morning. And I talk about the IAEA report in it. Apparently, it's based on satellite photos of some kind of a steel container facility. Now, as far as I know, satellites, they can see plenty on the ground. They can get very close images, but they're not like Superman. They can't penetrate any kind of barriers and see inside of them. At least I don't think so. So based on seeing some kind of a metal or steel, they say, container, ipso facto, there's a nuclear weapons development program going on inside. I mean, they may be playing chess. Who knows what's going on in there? Who knows what it's even for? But how do you come up with an assumption like this? Well, I picked up a few comments that is coming down very hard on the IAEA for suggesting this, including quoting, and as far as Iran being a nuclear threat, I quote a former Israeli Mossad director, not exactly a friendly type, and he says flat out, quote, Iran is not an existential threat. I think everybody knows that. Iran hasn't attacked another country in over 200 years. Doesn't threaten any now. Its neighbors aren't worried, but it's got plenty to worry about.
Well, yes and no, Steve. I think that it's obviously true that Iran is never going to be an existential threat to anybody in terms of planning an aggressive war or launching an unprovoked nuclear attack. That we can take for granted. The Zionist entity over there in occupied Palestine has over 400 nuclear weapons on air trigger alert, aimed at all the European capitals, apparently, as well as the Middle Eastern ones. And so obviously anybody who launched an unprovoked nuclear attack would be committing suicide. So what's it really all about? Well, I think that Iran does present an obstacle to total Zionist slash American domination of the Middle East. And it does that not through its military so much as through its, number one, its moderately successful example of an Islamic democracy, which has persevered despite the extreme harassment coming from the U.S. and the West, sort of the same way Cuba has. And secondly, the leadership in Iran, as well as the essentially the entire population, is very clear about the fact that it will never accept a permanent apartheid Jewish state in occupied Palestine, that the regime that's occupying Jerusalem will vanish from the pages of time, as the Ayatollah Khomeini put it, and as Ahmadinejad quoted him, and as everybody in Iran, I'm sure the polls would show 98% plus, agrees. So in that sense, Iran is being very honest and outspoken in its opposition to the Zionist American Empire, and that is the real reason that it's being targeted.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Kevin. And again, Iran poses no threat I'm aware of. Israel poses an immense threat. For decades, it's had a very imposing nuclear weapons program. You mentioned 400 nuclear weapons. Who knows exactly how many they have? But they've been developing them. They wanted a nuclear weapons program and a chemical and a biological program as well. And there's less information available on those. At least the last time I wrote an article about all three, I put in the information that I could find. There was a lot on the nuclear weapons program. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, wanted nuclear weapons. And I forget the man's name, but he enlisted the support from some scientific expert to begin developing it. And that goes back, I guess, to the early 1950s. So Israel has been at this all this time. It's got the Dimona facility. Mordecai Vanunu, who worked there, outed it to the Times of London, I think it was, back in the 1980s. And Israel put him in prison in solitary confinement for something like 18 years. And off and on, they stick him back in prison again. They won't let him leave the country. He wants nothing to do with Israel. He simply wants to get out. There's a whole bunch of restrictions put on him. Basically, he's under arrest even when he's not behind bars. And because he was there, he knows what's going on. Well, it's already out in the open. It's not a secret anymore. And his, whatever he knew, Kevin, goes back to the 1980s. My God, look at what Israel has done since then. So his information is way out of date. He's no threat to Israel. You and I may know more. Well, I mean, Mordecai can read just like you and I can. So we're probably on an equal footing on what we all know about Israel's nuclear weapons program. Maybe Israel should put us all under house arrest.
Right, right. There's a lot of hypocrisy there. And, you know, since we're coming up on November 22nd, I think we should mention that among the great many motives for the secret government's murder of President John F. Kennedy back in 1963, and there's, of course, a long list, starting with Kennedy's determination to start a process of complete disarmament, not just nuclear test ban, not just ending nuclear weapons, but complete disarmament between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And the Soviets were going crazy. They were so happy. They were replaying his peace speeches over and over on Soviet state TV. That was maybe reason number one. And secondly, of course, he was pulling out of Vietnam and making friendly with Castro. But a third reason that hasn't gotten so much play is that Kennedy was in a showdown with Ben-Gurion over Israel's nuclear program. He was bound and determined to put an end to that program before it started. And Ben-Gurion was just as bound and determined to make sure that Israel developed its nuclear capability. So it seems quite likely that among the networks that were mobilized to terminate John F. Kennedy's presidency with extreme prejudice were the Zionist-linked organized crime networks, that is both the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, and its assets in the U.S., and in particular its organized crime assets, Meyer Lansky being the top organized crime leader in the world. And the Lansky mob worked very closely with Israel and had loyalty to Israel even beyond the way it worked with the CIA. So it doesn't seem implausible that this issue of whether or not Israel would get a nuclear capability was one of the factors in the termination of Kennedy's presidency.
Oh, I think there are so many reasons why people like Mossad. I always thought the assassination of Kennedy was a combination CIA-Mossad plot.
Right.
I mean, they're basically partners in crime.
Like 9/11.
You could name all the major events, 9/11, killing Kennedy, maybe killing Martin Luther King. I mean, Bobby Kennedy. Probably the CIA and Mossad had a dirty hand in all of it. And hitmen, my God, I mean, guns for hire are all over the place. I mean, mafia, lone rangers, crime elements in other countries. Plenty of people, for the right price, will go out and try to kill anyone. And if somebody parades down the street in the open, it makes it so darn easy to do. And if they don't, well, I mean, these are smart operators. I don't know anything about being a professional killer, Kevin.
Well, that's good. I don't either. Not firsthand, anyway.
If they make it a profession, especially if they can get help like secret poisons that are undetectable, whatever they want to do to kill someone, they can go ahead and do it. By the way, Jack Kennedy was my commencement speaker in college. It was 1956, so at the time, it was Senator Kennedy. And I honestly don't remember his talk because other things were on my mind. And the day happened to be a blistering hot day, and the commencement was outdoors. And there we were in cap and gown, sweating like hell. And I forget what the order of events were, but maybe by the time the commencement speaker came around, everybody just wanted to get the damn thing over with so we can get this damn cap and gown off. But I went back later, and I read his talk. It was a marvelous talk. You do not hear presidents or politicians talk the way he did, scholarly, reasoned. And I had to write about him because of that speech, so I included a lot of other things in it, and I quoted him verbatim from what he had to say. I think it was June 16th, 1956, so long ago. I think another reason, Kevin, on wanting to get rid of him, he wanted to recognize the Palestinians. So my God, over 50 years ago, Kennedy was not happy about the occupation of Palestine. Well, no, Palestine wasn't occupied then. That was after his death, 1960s. No, well, the West Bank and Gaza were not occupied, but 7 years.
Right. It's, well, you know, which part of Palestine is occupied when, of course, has been a long, sad story.
Oh, absolutely. Well, 78% of historic Palestine was taken by Israel in 1948. Jerusalem made a UN protectorate, still is. Most people don't know that. An international city that's a UN protectorate. And even Washington does not have its embassy there. Sooner or later, that'll probably end. But the Bush administration wouldn't dare do it. Obama doesn't do it. So the embassies are in Tel Aviv instead. And Israel wants Jerusalem all for itself. But Kennedy wanted Palestinians to have official recognition. So it wasn't the occupation. But he wanted something Israel was very upset about.
And so he was the last president to stand up to the Zionists. Carter did up to a certain point and ended up with a one-term presidency, and so did George H.W. Bush, believe it or not. He was in their pocket most of the time, but he did go ahead and sell some planes to Saudi Arabia that angered them greatly. But really, there's been no U.S. president that stood up to the Zionists since Eisenhower did with the Suez Crisis, and then Kennedy did in both supporting the Palestinians, as you say, and then also being absolutely determined that Israel would never develop nuclear weapons capability.
Oh, absolutely. I can remember writing about the Eisenhower incident to Israel on its own with Britain and France. Wasn't it at the time?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And Eisenhower just told them to go home, and they did.
Well, Israel was a young upstart then. I think what Ike was mad about was, Jesus, they didn't even call and tell me what they wanted to do.
Well, yeah, that's true. But see, also at that time, Steve, the U.S. was playing its own hand to its own advantage by saying, we're not an imperial power. You know, those evil Europeans are imperial powers, and those, you know, those Israelis, sure, they're, you know, settler colonials, but we Americans, we're different. We support democracy and self-determination. Look at what Wilson said, you know, that sort of line. And believe it or not, the Middle Eastern people were buying it. You know, they were very positive about the U.S., and I think that by cozying up to the Zionists by way of the murder of Kennedy and putting the Zionist stooge Johnson in the White House and the whole series of Zionist stooges in Congress and the White House ever since, the U.S. has squandered its own ability to use soft power to get its way in the Middle East, and it's, by way of its tremendous popularity. The U.S. enjoyed massive approval throughout the region during the Eisenhower and Kennedy years, and that's all gone now.
Oh, it really is gone now. America really is reviled. Israel is reviled. And the more horrific policies they pursue, Kevin, the greater the revulsion among millions of people. Certainly people in the Middle East, Central Asia, probably have more reason than anybody to feel this way. But look what America, I was going to mention African countries. They have reason to revile all the Western imperialists. I mean, the entire continent really for centuries has been ravaged and pillaged by Western countries in earlier centuries. My God, they all pitched in. I mean, even Belgium. King Leopold considered the Congo, which is a massive country territorially, as big as Western Europe, as big as America is, from the Atlantic to the Mississippi River, and this tin horn King Leopold decided it was his private plantation. I mean, this is the kind of arrogance you get from Western countries. So I just can't imagine why people, if their ancestors passed down this information, why they would ever trust any Western country at all, whether it's America, whether it's Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Belgium, tiny Belgium. I mean, all of them, they're up to no good.
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of trust, Steve. I think what happens is the leaders of these countries end up in the kind of position that John Perkins describes in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, when he would go visit heads of state and hold out his two fists and say, well, here's a pile of $100 bills in this hand and here's a bullet in the other. Which one do you want? So that's not, it's not trust. It's like, what are they going to do? And, a lot of those people have taken bullets or more likely plane crashes because they turned down those kinds of offers.
Oh, indeed so. And when you talk about either a bullet or a fistful of money, my feeling is that that went on in Libya, Kevin, where people defected from Gaddafi and came over to the other side. And I think they basically, as they say, got an offer they couldn't refuse. The good one was, we will deposit tax-free, unknown only to you and us, $5 million in a numbered Swiss account, or we'll kill you.
Yeah. Well, I have a friend who, in fact, I have a number of friends, but one in particular who comes from eastern Libya, and he and his friends were all persecuted under the Gaddafi regime. And he's talking about going back there now, but the word is, through him and through my other Libyan contacts, that they're not happy, and these are the anti-Gaddafi people, by the way. They're not happy because they just, they're saying that, there are U.S. people there who are being, American troops and or mercenaries or special force, whatever you want to call them. There are Americans on the ground in Libya now, whatever Obama says, and they're behaving arrogantly as always. And also there are people mainly from Qatar, but other U.S. allies in Libya as well, who are, according to my contacts, behaving even worse and more arrogantly than the Americans. And so now the people who made this revolution, the anti-Gaddafi people, are faced with this big problem. Well, how do we get rid of these Americans and these Qatar troops who came in here ostensibly to help us, but are now acting like they own the place?
Well, I'm no expert on Libya, but I've certainly written a lot about it, Kevin, going back to around last February. I would say probably on the order of maybe 6 articles, and recently in the past few weeks, I've written maybe 6 or 8 more. So I've written so much, and I never knew all that much about Gaddafi. I learned an awful lot writing these articles. No leader is perfect. The best America ever had, and we could debate that issue alone, but the best America ever had many, many flaws. Many, many flaws. Name any of them. Washington, Lincoln, Roosevelt. We could spend the program ripping apart each one of them for the things that they should have done that they didn't. The policies they supported, they were awful despite the good things
right.
that they may have done. So Gaddafi was no saint. but I remember a line I used in one article, as despots go, and I'm not sure despot is the right way to describe Gaddafi, but let's say, as alleged despots go, you'd want to live under Gaddafi before you'd ever want to live under the better known ones, who without question were absolutely ruthless. I mean, Gaddafi brought just amazing social benefits to everyone in the country. I mean, this stuff was out there. Everybody could take advantage of it, including, I mean, all kinds of stuff besides healthcare, education. There were no homeless people under him. Everybody got a stipend to be sure they had a roof over their heads. Everybody got lots of stuff.
Well, you know, I think there was some uneven distribution of all those goodies between the East and the West. And again, you know, Libya is in a position where it's not very hard to do that because it's got a low population compared to its oil resources. I think what the people who rebelled against Gaddafi, such as my own contacts from Libya, objected to was his utter and complete ruthlessness in putting down any form of opposition in a kind of a really totalitarian way. And the other countries in the region are not all that much better. You know, I was just arguing with my wife about this. She's from Morocco, and, you know, she kind of prefers Gaddafi, in fact, strongly prefers Gaddafi to the king of Morocco, who is somewhat less brutal. That royal family they're very brutal. They have a CIA-built torture chamber, but they're not using it now as much as they used to. And you can get away with criticizing them. Right now, there are lots and lots of Moroccans who are putting up very strong, revolutionary YouTube videos, and they're not all being disappeared, tortured, and killed. Whereas, I guarantee you, Steve, during Gaddafi's period in Libya, anybody who put up even a mild opposition to Gaddafi YouTube video, it was going to have a life expectancy measured in if days or perhaps even hours, and they weren't going to have a real good time while they were dying. So there's a kind of extreme brutality to Gaddafi's regime, at least according to the people I've heard. And I mean, if you can show me during his regime that there were a lot of, for instance, YouTube videos coming from Libya by people under their real names criticizing him and calling for uprisings or revolutions or whatever, like there are coming out of Morocco today, then, you know, I'll take that point well. But I don't think so. I think it was a pretty nasty totalitarian regime. And so, sure, it treated its people well economically. But do you really want that? I mean, would you live under that kind of a regime? I would rather be starving and be able to tell the truth and call for a revolution without instantly being disappeared and tortured rather than being taken care of well materially by my government, but murdered and tortured the second I got out of line.
Well, I honestly don't think it was that bad, and I wrote one article about why Gaddafi, I'm sorry, I did write one on why Gaddafi was ousted. I wrote another one on literally, Kevin, he came to power in a bloodless revolution in 1969, and literally almost from the get-go, he was targeted by America and other Western countries for elimination. There were numerous, I have no idea how many, but probably dozens, many dozens of attempts to kill him. Now, if you and I had survived dozens of assassination attempts, I think we would be very skittish about anything that we discovered was going on, and we would certainly try to snuff it out any way we could. Otherwise, we might not see the sun come up the next day, and I think that was very much on Gaddafi's mind. I do know also that he devolved a lot of power locally because Libya, as you mentioned, Libya is a small country, about 6 million people. Again, I agree, it made it much easier to distribute resources equitably, and some got more, maybe some got less. Maybe some of the people that were very nasty got less, but anybody who didn't challenge the regime could cheer just as well as anybody else. There were elements that did not share the feelings of others, but Libya is a tribal country, hundreds and hundreds of tribes, some more supportive, some less supportive, but I think the majority supported Gaddafi, and he devolved a lot of power to the tribal society, and I think this was a political move, because the way to get along there was you've got each, the tribes have local power bases. The way to get along and survive would be to work with them, not against them. And I think he was smart enough politically to know that. So a lot of power devolved to a local level, So in that respect, he was less of a tyrant than most people make him out to be. Again, I'm no expert. I read an article by, I think it was an American, I'm not sure, a Westerner, and I think an American, if not an American, a Canadian, who years ago traveled to Libya and met him and had a conversation with him, and I read the article. It made Gaddafi seem like I don't want to say a decent sort of fellow, but he was asking questions like, you know, why do these people in the West distrust me or dislike me? Here you and I are sitting here talking, and you seem to know something about Libya, and why don't other people know these things, and why are they saying such nasty things about me? Of course, in 1986, Kevin, Ronald Reagan tried to kill him and failed.
Right. Well, you know, I actually have always kind of liked Gaddafi. I hate to admit it, but it's, you know, I've always admired his independent spirit. He's an interesting writer. He's actually written poetry in Arabic that's not bad, which, I mean, how many heads of state in the West could publish decent poetry? So, you know, he's an interesting guy and far from all bad. I think my problems with him, first, are the totalitarianism I mentioned and the brutality with which it was enforced. And, of course, you're right that when you're in a position where the world's biggest powers are trying to get rid of you, it's hard not to be pretty brutal. Castro, of course, had to throw his opposition in jail and mistreat them in order to defy the will of the U.S. all these years. And, you know, that's, you know, if you don't like it, then stop trying, you know, stop sending American troops to kill these people. So that's a good argument. But the other thing is I think that Gaddafi kind of misread the overall political landscape of North Africa and the Islamic world in general by taking a kind of a tribal and idiosyncratic approach to Islam and mixing that with a certain kind of socialism and doing it in a way that didn't really connect with the masses of people across the Arab and Muslim worlds at a time when Arab nationalism was giving way to Islamic activism. And his opponents were mostly Islamic activists who, like me and like more than two-thirds of the world's Muslims, want to put an end to all Muslim-majority countries as separate countries and merge them into a new ummah or neo-caliphate. That's the big project these days. And Gaddafi was actually a divisive influence in that the movement for genuine liberation of the Islamic world through overcoming these colonially created nation states and reinstating an Islamic caliphate or ummah. And so for that reason, I'm not mourning his passing nearly as much as a lot of people are, although I sure liked him better than, you know, just about any American president since Carter or Kennedy. But I don't think his passing is such a disaster. You know, so there are people who are, like, including my own wife, who are sort of tearing their hair out and saying, this is terrible. These imperialists have just, you know, had their way with Libya and they're going to get all the oil. And I disagree. I think this U.S. empire is in its death throes. And within a few decades, we're going to see the beginnings of a united Islamic world, and the U.S. empire and the Zionist entity are going to be history.
Well, I certainly hope you're right, Kevin. I feel different about Gaddafi. I know what NATO, and NATO means Washington leading it, because the U.S. Admiral is the head of NATO and the number two commander. U.S. Admiral Stavridis, something like that, a Greek name, U.S. General Carter Ham, head of AFRICOM, is the number two, and a Canadian general for show. He's the one they put up to make it look like this is not an American war. It was, and it still is an American war, because America plays backseat to no one. And I know what they did to Libya, and they literally ravaged it, and they murdered, literally, mostly civilians, tens of thousands. My estimate is minimally 100,000 Libyans in a country of 6 million people.
What's your source for that estimate?
Well, I don't have a source, but I do know what they've done in some cities. There was one city with a population of 30,000 that was completely eliminated, mostly by ethnic cleansing, but in the process of ethnic cleansing, these were the rebels, and I call them what the Libyan loyalists call them, rebel rats. I mean, these were cold-blooded killers, an assortment, not just Libyans who wanted something different. The leadership of these rebels, Kevin, are really Al-Qaeda types, Islamic Libyan, is Islamic extremists, Al-Qaeda types, the same people that America enlisted to fight, the same type of people America enlisted to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, maybe you know more about this. I can't seem to recall. Maybe enlisted as well in Iraq, but these were the people who went to war with America after the 2003 war, so-called liberation, and their war still rages. Killings go on every day. Car bombs go off all over the country. And, of course, in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen of the 80s, I guess basically are the Taliban today, they want their country back. I mean, right. The Iraqis want their country back. The Libyans want their country back. And I must say, Kevin, I'm absolutely convinced if a legitimate poll could be taken under the current conditions in Libya, it would show a vast, vast majority, well over 90% of Libyans, revile NATO, revile America, want them out, they want their country back, and I am convinced, and I've written it many times, that a protracted conflict will continue, and it's going on right now. Rebel groups are contesting themselves because, I mean, they went in, whatever kind of deal they got, they were mercenaries, they were paid, at least they were promised payment, and they want something for having gone in, they got shot up, they got killed, and they don't want to just say, well, thank you very much, shake hands and goodbye, on to the next war. I mean, they want something. So they are battling each other for power bases. They are battling the NATO forces, the ones that are on the ground, special forces, U.S., U.K., France, Qatar, I suspect each Egyptian also, maybe some others, and the Jamahiriya loyalists, the ordinary Libyan people who simply want to live free in peace, not war. They are in the fight all over the country, and the reports coming through the U.S. media are absolutely bogus. The idea that this war ended on the 31st of October, the idea that NATO said it's all over, we're done, is a bald-faced lie. The war still goes on. NATO did not come to leave. NATO came to stay. The plan is to build one or more super bases for America, and I have heard that Israel wants a base in Libya, if you can imagine that. Well, you know, if they want it, they're probably going to get it. The Libyan people don't want them there. So this war is raging. There are still vast parts of Libya that are mostly in loyalist hands. And even in cities like Tripoli, Kevin, the war continues. When Hillary Clinton supposedly came to Tripoli, I'm not all that sure she came there, because there were battles going on, including one around the international airport, maybe around a military airport. How in the hell did she take a chance landing an airplane there? Mm-hmm. Who knows what kind of weapons these people have?
Yeah, I wouldn't put that past them. I think you're right, Steve, that the Libyan people may find that they're faced with a situation where they have to do what the Iraqis have done, which is resist the occupation of their country. One hopes it won't come to that, because the excuse that these foreign forces had coming in was, oh, we're just helping this rebellion. And if they stick around, it makes it obvious that that's not the case. Additionally, you know, you're talking about Al-Qaeda as a bunch of militant extremists, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yes and no. I think that what's the basis of Al-Qaeda's ideology, what their real project is, to develop a military deterrent by any means necessary, any kind of military deterrent they can come up with that will allow the people of the Islamic world to get what they want, which is to rebuild the caliphate or the ummah, that is, get rid of these colonially carved out nation states and return to an Islamic superstate. And that is what the vast majority of the population wants. Likewise, the vast majority of the population does want the legal system to be based on Sharia, which is traditional Islamic law. Just as we in the U.S. would prefer to remain under our own kind of traditional law, people in the Islamic world want to live under theirs. So Al-Qaeda is in itself is not extremist, it's just honest and straightforward. It's been infiltrated by false flag people, and that's
Oh, absolutely, Kevin. We're going to take a break and come back. In America, I'd be happy to live under any law that's enforced, wouldn't you?
At this point, pretty much.
Let's take a break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back on with Kevin Barrett. We're talking an awful lot about the Middle East, which is so important, Kevin, because there's just so much going on there, whether it's Libya or we're talking about Iran earlier. We could talk about Israel, Palestine. Have you focused on the goings-on there, the UNESCO fiasco, the two aid ships to Gaza that were intercepted? They'll be put through the third degree. You could be sure of that. I'm sure you've got some thoughts on both of those.
Well, yes, of course. It's yet another of these crazy moments where the you know, extreme Zionism shoots itself in the foot over and over, and you just wonder how long they can do that before they just reduce their own viability to nil. These aid ships were able to set off by not making it clear where they were going, apparently. And once again, Israel is going to be presumably brutalizing and mistreating people who were simply trying to break this genocidal blockade of Gaza, you know, the world's largest open-air concentration camp that's missing medicine and infrastructure and everything else that keeps human life going. And, you know, their attack on the Mavi Marmara a couple of years ago was just about the dumbest thing that the Zionists have ever done. And I think that will be noted in history as the time that they, you know, created their own course to destruction, because it turned Turkey against Israel. Before that, Turkey had been Israel's number one ally in the region, and by attacking the Mavi Marmara and murdering those 10 plus Turkish folks, including one American citizen, of course we never heard about that over here in the mainstream media, these Israelis underlined the utter desperation and brutality of their regime, and it led the Turks to create a situation basically where the Turkish government under Erdogan was able to purge the Zionist plants in the armed forces, the people who've been threatening to stage coups d'etat down through the years, the people who threatened a big false flag attack on Turkey to end democracy there. And so now the Islamic and democratic forces, which are exactly the same people, are in firm control in Turkey, and they've made it clear that from now on, Israel is not a friend, it's an enemy. And the loss of Turkey, which is growing at 10% a year, it's really the big powerhouse of the future, I think, on the Eurasian continent. And by losing Turkey as an ally, the Israelis have just sealed their own fate in the long term. And so what's going on now is a series of desperation moves as they pull the puppet strings on the U.S. to get the U.S. to cut funding to UNESCO, just because UNESCO has recognized Palestine, and they go out and they interdict and brutalize more boats to Gaza, and they start ranting about launching an attack on Iran, which of course would bring down a lot of missiles on Tel Aviv, and you know the whole country would empty of its Jewish population once again, as happens every time that there's anything serious coming at Israel, which shows you just who really has a commitment to live there and who doesn't. So I think that it really we're just kind of watching the Zionist regime in its death throes as it clamps down on its control of the U.S. and behaves more and more in an extremist fashion. And it's a vicious circle. The more the crazier they get, the more they destroy their own future. So I think it will continue to accelerate, and we will see the end of the Zionist entity long before most people realize it.
Well, you know, it's been quite some time, I think 2 years or more ago, that I don't know who came up with this, and I can't vouch for the accuracy, but I quoted something, might have been in Haaretz, I can't recall, it was so long ago, but I quoted supposedly CIA information saying that it gave, based on the way Israel is acting today, CIA gave it a shelf life of maybe another 20 years.
Yes, I saw that, and I think they got that right.
Well, I mean, they're basically saying what you're saying, and I agree with you. And a man I had on this program once, Emmanuel Wallerstein, who was a pretty astute observer of geopolitical events, he's written about, and I've quoted him. I wrote one article about what he has written in several books, and we discussed it a little bit when he came on this program a good number of months ago, that he gives the way things are going in America maybe another 30 years or so, and then something much different will happen. And his prediction is that he cannot tell whether the change will be for a more people-friendly society or, God forbid, something much worse than we have now. In other words, what do we get? Utopia or Nazism? I mean, what? You know, it's like the old soap opera. Well, the old serials I used to see as a kid in the movies, where they wanted to get you back next Saturday before TV was for kids my age, 10 years old or so, go to the movies to watch, you know, the latest movie at the neighborhood theater, and they would always show serials. And they would leave you hanging to bring you back next week for the next episode. Well, that's the way I feel about this.
Well, you know, it's not just people on the left, like you guys, that are saying this. I had Pat Buchanan on my radio show 2 days ago, and it was Wednesday, that's right. A lot of people would put Pat as the number one conservative commentator out there. Certainly, you know, he is a cut above, you know, O'Reilly and Hannity and these other, you know, mindless idiots. And Pat Buchanan's latest book is called Death of a Superpower: Will the U.S. Survive Until 2025? So he's 2025, that's actually sooner than you're talking about. And of course, he sees somewhat different reasons than you and I do. He agrees with me that the loss of religion does lead to a breakdown in morality and social cohesiveness, and that's a factor. You may not agree with that. But he does also argue that the U.S. is losing a certain kind of, you know, racial, ethnic cohesiveness, and I think that's nonsense. I don't think we ever really had that, you know, maybe after the 1700s. And in fact, where I disagreed with him very strongly is that I think the real problem is that we're losing the idea behind our existence, because the U.S. is not an ethnic nation. It's an idea nation. You know, a lot of countries are ethnic nations, not us. We are built on this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We're built on the idea of the Bill of Rights, of individual freedom. And that's what we're losing, and we've lost it because of this insane, bogus war on terror. You know, these neoconservative lunatics blew up the Twin Towers and imposed a kind of Orwellian fascism that dare not speak its name on us. And by doing so, they destroyed our very reason for existing as a nation, the one thing that holds us together, which is our freedom and the Bill of Rights. And today, even Obama, the liberal constitutional scholar, says that as president, he or whatever panel is behind him can arbitrarily designate American citizens as enemies and have them summarily executed or perhaps disappeared and tortured. And this is obviously the end of America as a free society. It's the end of the Bill of Rights. It's the end of the idea of America. And if we don't stand up and overthrow these crazies and reinstate our Constitution, I agree with Pat and with you guys and everybody else who's saying that we don't have very long before the whole thing just completely falls apart and, you know, we get a reversion to barbarism, an experience maybe a little bit like the Soviet Union had when it fell apart in 1990, only probably a lot worse. because we don't have the tradition of working together the way those guys did. You know, we're all kind of out in it for ourselves. And so when things totally fall apart and you can't get food, you can't get gasoline, there's no power, God help us.
Kevin, I agree. On the one hand, I agree with Chalmers Johnson, who died a year ago this month, and he saw America really descending into hell, bankrupting itself. These imperial wars are killing us. Our freedoms are being crushed. I mean, this is just going on and on and on, and you see a Democrat, Obama, who at least can put a complete sentence together, unlike George Bush, and his policies literally are worse than the ones under Bush. Bush was very coarse compared to a smooth Obama, but the policies are worse. The idea that everybody is fair game to be assassinated on the word of the executive alone. I mean that he's calling Bush called himself a unitary executive, another word for dictator, and Obama, whatever he calls himself, you know, the idea that a president on his own word can say, kill this guy, well, that's another designation for a dictator. Also, he decided on his own that people can be held indefinitely detained with no charges, and they never have to be released. Why? Because we just don't think they should be let out. There's a possibility they may threaten America. There's no evidence to suggest it. But we're not going to take a chance. So maybe they'll come after you, Kevin, or come after me and say, we just don't want to risk it. We think there's a chance. We don't have any evidence. But just to play safe, we're going to lock these guys up. Well, that's,
and of course, one of the problems with this, Steve, is that this breakdown in the rule of law is always going to work both ways. It's going to have blowback. Basically, when the people in power say, okay, we've abolished the rule of law and we're going to just kill you anytime we want for any reason, then, of course, the people are going to say the same thing. They're going to say, well, okay, you took away our protection, you took away our rule of law. At that point, you know, what can we do except behave the same way you do? And so we're going to come and kill you. And so you end up with, you know, everybody, you know, the war of all against all out of Thomas Hobbes' nightmare. And again, I mean, I don't see any difference between Obama ordering the murder of some guy of Awlaki and Awlaki ordering the murder of Obama. I mean, it's, in both cases, it's an equal and opposite breakdown in the rule of law, and that's how it's always going to work. If you have the breakdown coming from the leadership, then the people aren't going to respect the rule of law anymore either, and you get that descent into hell.
Well, it sure is. And whether or not Awlaki wanted Obama dead, whatever he may or may not have wanted to do, Kevin, his concern was self-defense. There are international laws that guarantee the right of self-defense. The same as the Palestinians, Kevin. When they fire rockets, they don't initiate them. They respond to Israeli attacks. Israel attacks Gaza with F-16. They shell them from the ground, tanks. They sometimes have incursions. They bring in these Abrams tanks and they shell people. They use illegal weapons like white phosphorus and thermobaric fuel air bombs, all kinds of stuff. And I quoted that evidence was uncovered that they not only use depleted uranium, America does all the time, so does Israel, but Israel and most likely America are both using enriched uranium weapons. I always thought uranium was uranium, and if you get irradiated, you have a serious problem. But maybe enriched is worse than depleted. I honestly don't know. I don't want to be contaminated with either. But both countries use these weapons. They're all illegal. And if people respond in self-defense, Kevin, we call it terrorism.
That's right.
Well, I call it what it is, self-defense. And if they want to get us, they can be very clever about it. I live in a high rise. I guess they could come get me, throw me out the window, and say I jumped.
Yeah. Well, you know, I give thanks that we're at least able to talk on the radio at this point without having anybody take us out quickly. Of course, it appears there are a few talk radio hosts who may have paid the price. You know, Bill Cooper is one that often gets cited. And he was on to 9/11 apparently before it happened, just as Alex Jones was. And they killed him right around then, at least so the story goes. I don't know the details of that too well. I wasn't paying attention to this stuff back then. But in any case, you're right. You know, self-defense is a basic human right. And in a sense, I think what the war on terror, so-called, is really all about is it is a war to try to preempt the Islamic world from using its, exercising its God-given right to self-defense. And why is that a problem? Well, because that right of self-defense might create a situation in which they're able to defend their own resources and get the benefit of their own resources, and they might also be able to take back the land in Palestine that was stolen from them. And a lot of people here don't realize it, Steve, but Palestine has been an Islamic territory and generally administered pretty fairly with justice to all three major monotheistic religions virtually for the entire period that Islam has existed, more than 1,400 years. It was at the very beginning of the Islamic era that Palestine came under the sway of Islam as the Byzantine Empire withdrew or was chased out. And it wasn't just the Muslims invading that did that. It was also the people rising up against their own Byzantine rulers and embracing the Muslim invaders who lived in tents and cut taxes to a tiny fraction of what they had been under the Byzantines, while they themselves lived in tents outside the city and allowed the Christians and the Jews to continue to worship freely and to keep their own wealth. That was the so-called conquest. It's been an Islamic land ever since, except for a couple of horrific, bloody interludes when the Crusaders took over and slaughtered everybody. So this is how it's seen in the region. And the idea that Zionist atheists posing as Jews could come and steal this territory and ethnic cleanse it and create a genocide of the population there and keep this ethnic-cleansed Jewish state going permanently is completely absurd. It's much, much crazier than if the Episcopalians had invaded and occupied, say, Peking to create a white Episcopalian state in Peking and expecting the Chinese to accept that forever. This is even worse. And so, you know, and we don't get that here in America. We just think that, oh, Israel, it's natural. You know, the Bible, Old Testament, God's real estate deed in perpetuity, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, that's not how it's seen on the other side of the world. And we better, you know, get into some dialogue with the people on the other side of the world who see it differently from how we do.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, the idea of transplanting a Western society into the middle of the Middle East and to get the people to go there after World War II, what would become Israel, had to con people from Eastern Europe. And of course, they used the Jewish Holocaust as the reason. You know, you got to get out of here before Nazism rises again.
Right, and what do the Palestinians have to do with the Holocaust?
Well, that's exactly right. And well, of course, it goes back to Balfour, 1917. And the Brits wanted a Western presence in the middle of the Arab world. I always compared it. Here I live in Illinois. You're up in Wisconsin. I always compared it. I mean, Israel is a small country territorially. One analogy I used to myself was, what if a brain was simply lifted up and parachuted down in the middle of Illinois, and they set up the Republic of Bahrain or whatever they wanted to call it? I mean, what the hell would the people who live there have to say about it? What would their neighbors have to say about it? I mean, who are these people? Who brought them in? Who gave them the right to steal our land? Well, that's exactly what the people who lived in the Middle East, in Palestine, and the surrounding areas for hundreds, over 1,000 years, whatever the number of years were, centuries, these people have a legitimate right to complain. And when Arabs, Christians, and Jews lived together pre-Balfour, pre-Israel, they got along just fine. When Israel came in, it all changed. The problem is Israel, and that has to be resolved. Israel, I agree with you, Kevin, will do it to itself. It will self-destruct. I hope you and I live long enough to see it, and so that these people can get their lives back again.
Well, I do too, Steve. You know, I mean, in a way, what I would really like to see most of all would be if the Israelis woke up and said, oops, you know, is it on Rosh Hashanah, the day when they have to apologize to people they've wronged? You know, if they would kind of have a collective apology to the Palestinians and say, okay, we admit it, you guys were right. come on back in, right of return, full citizenship, restitution. We're dissolving this as a Jewish state. It's now a state for all its people. We're really sorry for what we did. Please come back and we'll build a really good society. That would be the ideal situation. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's what I would like to see.
Oh, absolutely. I would like to see all peoples live together, whether it's the Muslims, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, White people, brown people, red people, everybody lives together. We're all human beings. I mean, there's only one species. You know, just like Howard Johnson's had, 27 flavors or something. I mean, human beings have many flavors, all sizes, shapes, colors, languages. I love diversity. I loved Howard Johnson's as a kid. I loved Baskin Robbins until I changed my diet. I mean, most people love that. So you wouldn't want to go in and you could have any, or Henry Ford, you could have any color you wanted as long as it's black. Well, you could have any flavor you want as long as it's vanilla or it's chocolate. Well, what if I want maple walnut? Well, I think diversity is great, and we all need to live together, and I would like to see, just like I'd like to see people in this country, Kevin, with the Occupy Wall Street movement, I'd like to see people on their own nonviolently manage to change the system. I'd like to see Israelis on their own, very angry about the social injustice, take on all forms of injustice and change the system nonviolently. If the people of Israel rose up and continued rising up and not quit, oh, the IDF, the Israeli military, they are the people of Israel. I don't think they're going to shoot their own people down. They just might end up joining them, and that could change everything. And if it happened here, Kevin, the same thing could happen. Can you imagine a world if that kind of change happened in both countries?
Well, that would be a much better world, wouldn't it? And here's to it. You know, let's hope this Occupy movement keeps going everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. We're out of town. You and I have to do this again. You are absolutely welcome back for another round. I am so into this discussion. I wish the next, I don't know if the next host is live or not, but I almost wish the next host wouldn't show up so we could spend another hour. There's so much more. There's never an end to discussing these kinds of things.
Okay, well, thanks so much. It's been great. I'll come back anytime.
Oh, I absolutely will have you back without any question. It's been a great hour. My great Thanksgiving. I'll just remind listeners to join us again tomorrow. Again, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. I promise another great program like this, and that's why I always say, make this a regular habit.